From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Inside the Mind of a Murderer, we talk with psychiatrist Roderick Anscombe about his work with the criminally insane and about his new novel, a retelling of the Dracula story. Also today, power guitar. We meet songwriter and guitarist Bob Mould, formerly of the band Husker Du, now leader of the band Sugar. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Air Force has brought charges of negligent homicide and dereliction of duty against an F-15 pilot who shot down two U.S. Army helicopters over Iraq in April. 26 people died. No charges have been mentioned against the second, less senior pilot, but five members of the AWACS radar plane that oversaw the action also faced dereliction of duty charges. The incident is one of the military's deadliest friendly fire tragedies. Attorney General Janet Reno says the Justice Department will move quickly to implement several programs in the crime bill. The priority programs are community policing, stepped-up border patrols, and payments to states with criminal aliens. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
Attorney General Reno says her department is well prepared to handle the thousands of requests from local police departments for their share of the 100,000 new police officers provided in the crime bill. Reno says she has several objectives in implementing the program.
Without red tape, in a way that will prevent waste, that will ensure the dollars are well spent, and that will get the dollars to communities as soon as possible.
Reno says states with criminal aliens in their prisons can expect checks from the government to start coming next year. She also says billions of dollars for prisons will be made available to states as quickly as possible. She says prosecutors who successfully put offenders behind bars should not have to see the person released early for lack of space. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Kmart is planning to close 110 stores. The discount chain says it will also eliminate 6,000 jobs and 10% of its management staffing. The chain says it needs to tighten its operations. The stores will close by February. The management staffers will leave over a period of 2 years. Kmart is facing increased competition. Many of its stores are older. The Food and Drug Administration has banned imports of some Canadian blood products into the United States. Adam Hochberg of member station WUNC reports.
The ban is the result of an inspection performed in July by the FDA at a Canadian Red Cross center in Toronto. The FDA alleged that the center didn't use reliable screening techniques for donors and also didn't do a good enough job tracing donors who may have been the source of blood tainted with the AIDS virus. The Canadian Red Cross had been shipping some of its blood products to a processing center in North Carolina, but those shipments have been blocked by the FDA until the Canadian Red Cross can meet U.S. safety standards. The FDA says there apparently was no danger to U.S. residents because even before the ban was put in place, the North Carolina center was used only to process the Canadian blood and send it back to Canada, and the blood supply from the Canadian Red Cross was not mixed with the supply used in the United States. For National Public Radio, I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up more than 21 points at 3,908. The Nasdaq is up 4.5 points at 768. This is NPR. The United Nations Conference on Population has temporarily set aside the controversial abortion issue to discuss spending plans to slow world growth. The abortion battle is so sensitive that a special committee has been appointed to deal with it. Delegates are now talking about a $17 billion plan to slow population growth, but there's disagreement on how to spend the money. Areas like family planning, AIDS prevention and research, and reproductive growth all need funding. The 20-year plan calls for developed nations to pay a third and the developing world to pay two-thirds of the spending goal. Developing nations say they cannot afford it. French President François Mitterrand said in an interview published today he's hopeful he will be able to govern until the presidential elections next spring. There's been speculation that the president's health has been rapidly deteriorating. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
President Mitterrand told the conservative daily Le Figaro that his health should allow him to finish a second term, but he said he could be wrong. Mita Hall has prostate cancer. He was operated on 2 years ago and then underwent a second operation in July. Press reports say he's undergoing chemotherapy. Mita Hall acknowledged that he had reduced his schedule, but he said he's fit to govern. Mita Hall also used the interview to try to defuse the controversy over his wartime past. Recent biography shows that the president had worked in the pro-Nazi French wartime regime for several years. But Mita Hall emphasized that he had also risked his life in the resistance. He said he was never in the extreme right. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Protestant extremists in Northern Ireland are ruling out a ceasefire similar to the Irish Republican armies. They say they first want to see British and Irish proposals for governing their province. They also insist on being sure that an IRA splinter group honors the truce and that British government, rather that the British government, has made no deals with the IRA. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. Roderick Anscombe knows the mind of a murderer. For 2 years, he worked with the criminally insane at a maximum security psychiatric institution. Dr. Anscombe is a psychiatrist who specializes in schizophrenia. He teaches at Harvard Medical School and now heads a hospital ward for mentally ill patients who are a risk to themselves or others. Using his knowledge of madness and crime, he's written a variation on the vampire story in his new novel, The Secret Life of Laszlo Count Dracula. This Dracula is not a supernatural being. He's a regular man who knows what evil is and has scruples. In fact, this Count Dracula is a 19th century doctor whose job is to save lives. Yet he murders women in crimes of passion by piercing their necks. He's aroused by the flow of their blood. Let me give you a glimpse of this Dracula at work with a reading from the book by the author.
I pressed forward until I felt the curve of her buttocks against me, and using this as a fulcrum, I arched her backwards bit by bit until I felt her chin and turned her face aside. At the last moment, she made as if to shake me off, but the cruel thorn of the Turkish dagger pierced her throat. I thrust and pulled, and the blood spurted from her in a great fountain, and I felt a surge of exultation, an ecstasy which I can compare only to the expression on the faces of saints at their moment of martyrdom. Then, suddenly, she was a dead weight, and would have toppled into the mud if I had not caught her and slowly lowered her to the ground where it was dry. I stooped to kiss Estelle farewell, without sensation in my lips. I was emptied and numb. The moment had passed too quickly. I felt cheated. Already the blood was forming into glistening clots, and signs of life as usual were reforming about me. Crows cawing at the edge of the wood, the muffled sound of cowbells, the gurgle of the river, the gradual fading of color as dusk fell, the surreptitious movement of the animal which had attracted Estelle's attention as it went about its business in the undergrowth. It had been too short. The event was like a rock hurled into the river, a violent splash, and then the water closes over it. Life flows on.
I'm wondering if any of that comes from your work with the criminally insane, a sense that the thrill that they felt in the act of murder passed too quickly and frustrated them.
It's totally mystifying to them. That's what I take from it. When I have seen them, it's often been within the first 48 hours after they committed the crime, and they're dazzled. They can hardly believe what they've done, that the person, often the person that they've loved, is gone, and they have done it. It's a mysterious act to them.
So you find when you've interviewed people after they've committed a crime that they're mystified by their own actions.
Yes, they're almost numb and bewildered, I think would be the best word.
Have you interviewed people who've committed murder who, like the person in your novel, enjoys seeing blood flow, actually finds that quite thrilling?
I have seen rapists who have done that. Sometimes they see the blood as almost a proxy for human emotion, and they need to extort that from their victims.
Tell me more about what criminals have told you about blood.
It gives them a thrill. It's almost like a sense of achievement, I think, that here is proof positive of the of the act. It's, you know, if you raise a bruise or even if you stab somebody, you don't really see the result. But here it is, if you open someone up and see them gushing, particularly if you hit an artery, it's almost like this is the real thing.
Another way that blood figures into your novel is through self-mutilation.
Yes.
One of Dracula's first victims is a woman who mutilates herself. And he wonders, is this desperation or a perverse courage, or is it some wild abandon? I found myself wondering if those were questions you asked yourself after watching perhaps patients who had mutilated themselves.
Yes, it's very common in a certain condition called borderline personality disorder. And when you admit patients into hospital, one of the things that you do is you look at their forearms, and that will tell you almost their history, because in some, and it's usually women, you'll see tracks, razor tracks, transversely across their forearms where they've cut themselves. And this occurs when they're feeling unreal, or when their emotion is so intense it almost blows out fuses for them. And they cut themselves, and the sight of the blood, this is what they tell me, the sight of the blood brings them back. It centers them. It brings them, it makes them feel real again.
Can you explain why?
I think it is something very basic. It's almost like life spurting out of you, it flowing. It's hot and warm and so bright and intense. What could be more lively than the sight of blood?
So you must have really thought about blood a whole lot while writing this book.
I thought about blood a bit. I thought mainly about the wounding. I've been troubled by how vampires get into people's necks, because it's really very difficult to do it with human teeth, even fangs, I would think.
Of course, vampires don't have human teeth. They have... You're right, they have fangs.
But fangs, you know, are used for ripping and tearing. They're not good for puncturing. When I was an intern, as part of my training, I was involved in a lot of neck surgery. The neck is really a tough part of the body to get into. The skin is like rubber. It jumps away from what you're trying to push into it, even a scalpel. You have to hold the skin tight. You have to press down. I think it would be very, very hard to get into someone's carotid artery. I think it's doable because the human jaw is so strong. It can bring such pressure to bear at its point of teeth. But I think you'd need more than just determination. You'd need a real passion to get in and get the blood. It would have to be very, very exciting for you to do that.
Well, of course, for a vampire, it's essential.
It's essential.
Their existence depends on it.
Yes, it's a nutritional requirement.
But now, in your novel, the Dracula character doesn't use his teeth. He uses a knife or a shard of glass.
Right.
So was that for technical reasons? Because you couldn't imagine physically a human teeth penetrating.
I can imagine, and I think Laszlo gradually works towards that. Laszlo is an apprentice killer. He discovers his true passion almost by accident when he kills his first victim in a vengeful rage. But it's almost like developing a taste for rare Scotch whiskey. He develops himself. He finds something within himself. There's a strand. And he goes along that strand deeper and deeper into his evil nature. So I think the first few killings are technically correct. They're glass, they're knives. But he works more and more towards his own center, which is to tear and bite and suck like an animal.
Did you ever have a patient who thought that they were a vampire?
Yes. I'm not sure whether it was real or whether he assumed that identity in prison to be scary, which is very important to be in prison, of course, and it certainly gave him a certain reputation. But he was a guy that bought blood from people.
He bought blood from them?
Mm-hmm.
How did he do that?
Well, you can buy most things in prison. It's, you know, you open up a vein and out it comes.
What did he tell you about why he needed the blood?
He liked it. I think it's one of those just, you come to the end of the road and that's that. You know, that's sex is like that. You know, why do people like certain things? I think it's, you know, the concrete is wet for a while, and then somewhere around 16 or whenever you think it happens, the concrete sets, and those are your kinks, whatever they are.
My guest is psychiatrist Roderick Anscombe. He's the author of the new novel, The Secret Life of Laszlo Count Dracula. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Roderick Anscombe, author of the new novel, The Secret Life of Laszlo Count Dracula. He's a psychiatrist who has worked with the criminally insane. How did you start working with the criminally insane?
Well, I had been working with psychotic patients pretty much all my career, and I wanted to do the most difficult. I wanted to work with the most dangerous, most psychotic, most disturbed people while I was relatively young, while I could, you know, absorb the buffets of a maximum security. And so I went to Bridgewater State Hospital, and I was assigned a special unit where they had the most dangerous patients in Massachusetts, and I loved it. It was wonderful.
What were some of the crimes people were there for?
Well, most of the people who had killed people would go through my unit. It was also an evaluation unit. And people who have recently murdered are at high risk for suicide. So they need to be in observation. They need to be observed acutely. Because murder is a devastating... I mean, I don't want to make excuses for these people, but murder is a devastating psychological trauma for everybody.
So what was your job?
My job was to treat people who are psychotic. And some of these men would be mentally ill and some would not. They were sent there for evaluation. And part of what I was to do in some instances was to evaluate them to see whether they were responsible for what they did or whether what they had done was really a manifestation of sickness.
This is always a line I find it hard to draw. I mean, not that anyone's going to ask a person like me to draw it, but I mean, in my mind, anyone who commits murder's got to be a little nuts, right? So what's the difference between somebody who commits murder because they're sick and somebody who commits murder because, well, they're not sick, they did it for another reason?
I think when someone commits murder when they're sick, it's pretty obvious. If you or I kill someone who we believe is the devil, who is stealing our thoughts, and that person turns out to be whoever they happen to be, I think most juries are going to see that as fairly obvious. I think when someone is in a manic state and unable to control their rage, that's more of a gray area. And then there are people who are simply drunk, as a lot of murderers are, drunk and kill people, and often they don't even remember what they've done.
When you would interview somebody to evaluate whether they were insane or not, what kind of questions would you ask in the interview?
You go very, very carefully through the events, almost second by second, and looking for opportunities. Could this man have done this differently? Did this man have the capacity to understand the true nature of what he was doing? And one of the things I wanted to give Laszlo throughout the book is the capacity to understand. I wanted him to understand what he was doing. So in the evaluation of these people, you go second by second, you know, hand movements, foot movements, very meticulous reconstruction of the crime.
One of the things that you have your character Laszlo Count Dracula say in the novel, after, you know, as he thinks to himself about the murders that he's committed, he says, "It is love, we monsters tell ourselves. We love too ardently, too anciently, too honestly, too bestially." But he's kind of explaining his crimes as crimes of passion, that he loves in such a grand way, that this is what happens. Did you come across patients who you were evaluating, criminals who you were evaluating, who also saw their crime in those terms?
Yes. I remember one man who was terribly depressed and thought that the world was such a cruel, heartless place that he wanted to save his family from it. And that clearly, that they didn't die, but they were almost dead. That was clearly an act of love. That was someone who was psychotic at the time, of course, not like Laszlo. But I think psychotic people are capable of very heroic acts. They're terribly misguided, but acts of great courage.
It also seems sometimes acts of great logic, but the logic is a very personal logic that isn't
yes.
logical to anybody who's sane.
Yes. They start from different premises.
Did you find that a lot of people who you worked with had remorse for their crimes?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Real remorse, as opposed to remorse they were faking for you or for the authorities.
Oh, real remorse, because most a lot of people kill the person that they love the most. You know, it's a man killing his wife or girlfriend, or often a man killing one of his parents when they're psychotic. So not only have they committed a terrible crime, not only are they going to spend the rest of their life in prison, but they are also bereaved. They've lost the person who matters most to them. So it's a terrible, terrible crime.
For Laszlo Count Dracula in your novel, murder and the taking of blood has a strong erotic charge.
Oh, it's the sex act for Laszlo. This is the charge. It's the sex at the point of death, the last thrust, the last gush of blood, yes.
Is this something you learned about through your work with the criminally insane?
No, they don't do that.
Why not?
Generally, I think there's some torture sometimes that people do. There's a need for pain in sadistic sex killers. I've seen that. I think it's not so much blood, it's the cries of pain and the pleading for mercy. I think that it's more of an emotional equivalent rather than the physical side of blood.
So what led you to create a character who is sexually aroused by blood?
Because I loved the legend. I thought the Dracula myth was wonderful, so atmospheric and so moody. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to take that story and just turn it upside down, to have all the expectations of the audience going completely the wrong way because they're thinking of the myth that all their expectations are headed one way and the story is going completely the opposite way, that Laszlo is not a monster, he's human, that there's a stake that goes in, but it's very hard to bang a stake in, and that he goes for blood, but it's not for nutrition, it's for something more earthy, more human, I think. Not a monster, a man.
Now you're working at a hospital where people have been diagnosed as being a danger to themselves or others.
Mm.
And tell us a little bit about your work there.
Well, these are people who have not responded to treatment with other doctors at other hospitals. So they're people who are going to be in the hospital for a longer period of time. They're very challenging patients. They're people for whom the illness has oftentimes become a way of life. So you have to, as it were, infiltrate. You're kind of a mole. You have to get in under the defenses and under the delusions.
Now, do your patients know that you've written a novel set in the 19th century about
yes.
A murderer who's related to to the myth of the vampire?
They wouldn't believe it.
They wouldn't believe it?
They didn't believe that I had written a book about Dracula.
Well, why not?
Well, I guess it's hard to reconcile the Dr. Anscombe on the ward with a writer who would write something gory like that. I try to be reassuring.
You tried to be reassuring after they found out about the novel?
Right.
What, that you weren't really loopy or
right.
flirting with terrible things?
Terrible things, yes.
And are they reassured?
I think they're intrigued. I think they're very intrigued. They kind of like the idea, this is my impression, they kind of like the idea that I might have a secret life or be or have something a little bit loopy, as you say. It makes for a commonality.
I wonder what you make of the popular fascination now with serial killers.
I think it started off as something ununderstandable. I think that people saw what they were doing and they couldn't understand how any human being could do these things. And I think it was a need to explain this part of human nature. And I think what we've ended up is we've extended our concept of human nature, our idea of what should we say, normal, regular guys do, has been extended over towards the left. Regular guys kill people. Regular guys commit serial murders. Regular guys are sadistic killers. These people are not mentally ill in the sense that doctors use the term. And I think what has happened is this fascination that, you know, who are we? What is a human being? And part of the answer to that question is a human being is also a killer.
You know, when I walk down city streets now, I can't help but think that there's a lot more crazy people than there used to be. And I think that's in part because of crack. You know, there's just a lot of people who are either very high or very in need of more drugs who are on the streets and confronting people asking for money or food or whatever. But I wonder if in your work you ever feel that more people are psychotic now than before, if you're seeing the result of drug use in your work.
Well, I think they're more visible. I think they're out on the streets more because they're not in hospitals. They've been discharged for various reasons, mostly political, unfortunately. But I think you're right about crack. Crack is terrible. Crack is dehumanizing in a way that a lot of mental illness is not. I've seen people who've killed because they're looking for money for crack. I've heard of people stealing from their money from their families. They've almost lost their humanity through crack. It's a terrible, terrible affliction.
In what ways do you think crack can be more dehumanizing than mental illness?
I think that in crack, you narrow down to one thought and one feeling and one desire and one goal. And I think in mental illness, there are different kinds, of course, but the one that matters most to me perhaps is schizophrenia. I think that is a great struggle to remain human and to keep your emotions and to keep the faith. There's a terrible struggle for the soul in schizophrenia between the hugeness of delusions to talk directly to God versus just to be a human being, just to be an ordinary Joe. And I see that as a great heroic struggle, whereas crack, I think, is a diminishment.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Dr. Roderick Anscombe is the author of the new novel, The Secret Life of Laszlo Count Dracula. He teaches at Harvard Medical School. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. How does years of playing power guitar affect your body? Coming up, we ask Bob Mould, formerly of the band Husker Du, now leader of the band Sugar, which has a new album. Mould's guitar playing influenced many of the grunge rock bands. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The White House says that a U.S.-led invasion of Haiti will not be launched to improve the political fortunes of President Clinton. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
Press Secretary Dede Meyers rejects any suggestion that the U.S. would invade Haiti just to shore up Mr. Clinton's sagging poll numbers. The issue arose when former Vice President Dan Quayle told NBC's Today show he thinks some people are suggesting just that to Mr. Clinton, but Meyers says that's ridiculous.
The consistent policy that is in support of democracy and free elections in Haiti, that is something that goes back over the course of several administrations, including the one in which former Vice President Quayle served.
Meyers also rejects Quayle's charge that Mr. Clinton has not adequately explained U.S. vital interests in Haiti to the American people. Meyers saying he has and he will. Bill Small at the White House.
There's a tentative settlement in a lawsuit over the Tailhook scandal. The lawyer for the Tailhook Association confirms the aviators group has reached a preliminary agreement with former Navy Lieutenant Paula Coughlin. She alleged she was sexually abused at the 1991 Tailhook Convention in Las Vegas. 80 other women backed up her claim with similar allegations. The Defense Department investigated, but no courts martial were filed. Coughlin is also suing the Las Vegas Hilton, where the convention was held. Her lawyers will meet with them tomorrow to talk about a separate settlement. Delegates to the UN's Population Conference have set aside the issue of abortion temporarily. They're now talking about financing a 20-year population stabilization plan. NPR's Silvio Poggioli reports from Cairo.
Today, the Vatican issued a statement saying it's especially alarmed that the plan would channel tens of billions of dollars to reproductive health services and nothing at all, it claimed, to education and reducing child and maternal mortality. The Vatican's position on abortion, which it fears will be acknowledged as an international right, has angered many delegates who consider abortion marginal to the real issues of population and economic development. Several speakers urged the Vatican to stop blocking the conference over one paragraph, which says, where abortion is legal, it should be safe. British Overseas Development Minister Linda Chalker pressed the Vatican and its Latin American allies to end the deadlock, which she said is a waste of valuable time. This is Silvia Poggioli in Cairo.
German Chancellor Helmut Kohl has said goodbye to French, British, and U.S. troops who have been stationed in Germany. The Allies came to Berlin nearly 50 years ago to occupy it after the end of the Second World War. Now they are leaving as friends. Kohl says Germany won't stand any longer on the sidelines when peace and freedom are at stake. He led a Berlin ceremony today marking the Allied airlift of 1948 and 49. He was joined by Secretary of State Warren Christopher, French President François Mitterrand, and British Prime Minister John Major. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained more than 22 points to end the day at 3,908. This is NPR. Protestant extremists in Northern Ireland say they won't adopt a ceasefire in their war to keep the region British. They say they want to hear more first about British and Irish plans for an overall settlement to the bloody conflict. The Combined Loyalist Military Command says it does not believe the Irish Republican Army's declared ceasefire is permanent. The group says it wants to be sure that the British government hasn't clinched a secret deal with the IRA. This is the Protestants' first statement in a week, and it's the first time the Ulster Volunteer Force and the Ulster Freedom Fighters have talked about duplicating the IRA truce. China says its ties with the United States would be strained by any U.S. attempt to upgrade its relations with Taiwan. The warning comes after the U.S. says it would rather will review ties with Taiwan. Washington wants to improve economic and commercial relations. The BBC's Simon Long reports.
The United States' decision to amend its Taiwan policy seems to have pleased nobody. Several members of the Congress have expressed disappointment the change did not go further, and Taiwan's foreign minister, Frederick Chen, has said he too is dissatisfied. But the fiercest criticism has come from China. The foreign ministry spokesman said the change would have a serious adverse effect on relations between Beijing and Washington, and said China would lodge an official protest. The United States switched diplomatic recognition from Taipei to Beijing more than 15 years ago. Ever since, it has, like China's other diplomatic partners, shunned official contact with the Taiwan government, despite a flourishing commercial relationship. But China's been alarmed by Taiwan's recent, more aggressive diplomacy.
Simon Long reporting. Reuters News Service is quoting a UN official who says two British jets were fired on in northern Bosnia today. Neither plane was hit, although they were attacked by surface-to-air missiles. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bob Mould is a hero to many rock bands and rock listeners. He's one of the most influential musicians in alternative rock. With his first band, Husker Du, he created a loud, fast, and furious guitar sound. It helped set the stage for what later became known as grunge rock. Mould is also a songwriter and singer. His career has progressed through several distinct stages. He co-founded Husker Du when he was 17. That band broke up 9 years later in 1988. After that, Mould retreated to a cabin in the Minnesota woods, writing more reflective songs and launching a solo career. His guitar playing, singing, and songwriting are now showcased with his band Sugar. Before we meet Bob Mould, let's hear one of his songs from Sugar's new album, which is ironically titled File Under Easy Listening. Bob Mould, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello, Terry.
Let me start with what I'm sure will strike you and also many of our listeners is a really stupid question, but I'll ask it anyways. Why would a singer and songwriter like you want to bury their voice so far behind the guitar in the mix?
Well, I mean, sometimes when I'm at home constructing a song, and you know, especially I think with the more distorted guitar type songs, oftentimes I hear the voice as just something that complements the instrumental track. I don't hear it as a featured instrument per se. With a song like Gift that we just heard, where there's a lot of conflict involved, where everything seems to be fighting for a common space or for to stand out in front for a brief moment. I mean, that's really just the way I hear things in my head. It's not an intentional sabotage of the vocals or anything.
Was it ever challenging for you to find a way to combine songwriting with that kind of, you know, wall of guitar sound that you have?
Well, I think a lot of the songwriting process, you know, made itself apparent through the wall of guitar. When, you know, in a studio setting where I'm layering a lot of different electric guitars, you tend to pick up different, you know, just different order harmonics, you know, second and third order harmonics that suggest, you know, different high voices that you may not think about, and sometimes that affects your melodic sensibility towards a song. Lyrically, that's a separate thing, but you know, that's one way that things get constructed, is, you know, sort of by accident.
What's the feeling on stage of playing that kind of power guitar physically?
It makes your back hurt really bad.
Why does it make your back hurt?
Just the sheer amount of air that's being moved up there. I mean, at my microphone position, the guitar is usually about 125 decibels, and it's a lot to compete with. I mean, physically, it shakes your body really hard up there, and it's almost like you're fighting against that. Like you're fighting to keep your equilibrium, and it's an interesting experience up there sometimes.
Does that physical feeling feel different to you now at the age of 33 than it felt when you were a teenager?
Absolutely. it's not quite as pleasant a feeling anymore. But it has taken its toll a little bit. I mean, I've been out there for about 15 years doing this, and it's a lot. It gets to be a lot more work every time out. You know, I'm really starting to just think of other ways beyond sugar and beyond the very loud electric presentation, you know, to bring music to people.
Well, why don't I play something pretty acoustic from, this is actually from a Husker Du album, Too Far Down.
Okay.
You want to say something about the song and the performance?
Maybe the darkest song I think I've ever written. that should sum it up pretty quickly. It's a dark one.
About terrible depression?
Yeah, I guess the everyday depression.
Was it that bad?
some months it is, yeah. But no, it's a pretty striking song to me. It's one of my favorites.
Okay, well, this is Too Far Down.
If it was so easy to be happy, why am I so down? Well, all I can do is sit and wonder if it's going to end, or if I should just go away forever. When I sit and think, I wish that I just could die, let someone else be happy by setting my own self free. And you don't want the emotion, 'cause the taste it leaves is for real, but nothing's ever real until it's gone. And I might be too far down.
When you've played songs like Too Far Down that, you know, don't have that power guitar sound, do your audiences ever resist it? You've said that audiences usually want it louder, faster.
Mm-hmm. Anytime I pull out Too Far Down, it can usually silence the entire room. So it has as strong an impact as just a completely different one.
Good.
As opposed to the physical brute force.
What impact does it have on you to know that a lot of people in the audience want you to play louder, faster?
I have to follow my instinct. I mean, hopefully they will appreciate whatever context I present the music in. You know, I mean, when I'm up there, whether it's with Sugar or by myself, I mean, I'm in my own world. I can feel energy coming back. I can, you know, and you know, there's some interaction that's very unspoken and uncliched that happens between the audience and performer, but I mean, you have to follow your instincts up there. I mean, it's not about pleasing the crowd because of what they want, but pleasing the crowd because you're happy with your own performance and they can sense that.
My guest is guitarist, songwriter, and singer Bob Mould. His band Sugar has a new album called File Under Easy Listening. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Bob Mould. Now, you grew up in upstate New York in mm-hmm. what, a small town?
Yeah, up near Lake Placid. Yeah, it was just a small farm town.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've read about you that your father used to bring home jukebox singles. Did he have a jukebox in his store?
No. It was like a Ma and Pa grocery store, almost like a Dobie Gillis type setup where it was attached to the house and all the kids would work in there. But the people in the small town who stocked the jukeboxes were also the tobacco vendors. So he was able to get them for a penny apiece when they pulled them off the jukeboxes.
Oh, so what did he bring home for you that you otherwise might never have heard?
Every pop single you can imagine from 65 through 67, and I still have almost all of them. I have an amazing Motown collection, an amazing trucker collection, like Leroy Pullins and all these, strange songs. You know, the interstate is coming through my outhouse and all this. You know, as well as all the Beatles, Beach Boys, Who, Holly's, Birds, Dylan, all that stuff. So, I was, exposing myself to that every waking moment that I had as a child.
So your father brought them home knowing you wanted them. They weren't for him, they were for you.
Oh, they were for me, absolutely. I mean, I would memorize the label copy on every single. I mean, I was that obsessed with music even at the age of 5 or 6.
So did you have to work in your father's store, in the
yep.
grocery store?
Absolutely.
What'd you do?
Just restocked, ran the cash register, just anything that needed to be done.
Did you see yourself possibly doing that when you grew up?
Working in a grocery store?
Mm-hmm.
No. No, I saw myself at the age of 7 or 8 being a musician, oddly enough.
Were you in bands before Husker Du?
I was in a band in the 4th grade. I used to have a little pretend studio at home, but it really wasn't a pretend studio. It was like a reel-to-reel machine that I would record, a lot of songs on. And, damned if those things are gone forever. But it was really... really ironic when I got back into making records with Husker Du that my mom had sent out this little recording studio sign that I'd made with one of those dino guns that I had up on my bedroom door. So sort of everything has come full circle. It's very weird.
Would you tell us a story of how Husker Du formed?
I moved out to St. Paul, Minnesota in fall of 78 to go to school at McAllister College, and...
This was your big break from the hometown.
Yeah, getting out of there, I was 17, and had been accepted to school, actually, my sophomore year. I kept taking my SATs all through high school, just as, early as I can remember, just trying to get out, and got accepted early on some kind of underprivileged program, I guess. My parents didn't have a whole lot of money, and still don't, but... So once I got out there, it was like, okay, now there's a big world in front of me and I can do some things. And just met up with Grant Hart and Greg Norton, the other two people that were in Husker Du. They both worked at record stores. We all had, mutual tastes in music and thought it would be wise to put a band together. Just very simple, usually the way most bands get together, I suppose, at the record store.
No, what did you think of Husker Du as doing that was different from what other bands were doing at the time?
We hated most everything that was going on in Minneapolis, Minnesota, or St. Paul, which was our home base at the time. I think not unlike a lot of non-media center cities in America in the late 70s, you would probably get to a period like 1980 and they'd just be finding out about punk rock and you'd have bands, playing on New Wave Monday or something, and wearing ripped up shirts and safety pins and doing Sex Pistols covers, and then the same band would probably show up on Friday at a suburban bowling alley doing Ted Nugent covers. And I think we just hated all that, and we really, sort of set out to destroy that by playing as fast as we could, as loud as we could, being as aggressive as we could, as belligerent as we could be. And it certainly made people sit up and take notice.
What were the typical highs and lows in the early days of the band for you?
If we got paid for a show, that was a real high point. A low point would be if the cops showed up, I guess, in real simple terms. I mean, in the developmental stage, if I think any kind of project or statement like that, it's really hard to say, oh, what an amazing show, or oh, what a lousy show. I think you're just running on fumes, and the good things are getting paid, the bad things are getting busted.
What would you get busted for?
Setting up in a public space and playing.
Outside?
Outside, or like in the basement of a dormitory or something, and then having like the campus police, Come and Kill the Power, or things, you know. I remember Husker Du putting on a, you know, putting on a little impromptu show in the laundry room of a dormitory I was living in, and it happened to be connected to the basement of another dorm where there was some kind of disco party, and essentially a full scale, you know, like 100-person fist fight broke out. And that was sort of an unnerving night. The only good thing was that was the night that I met Dave Perner and Danny Murphy from Soul Asylum,
mm-hmm.
as they were going to Marshall University High School, I think, at the time, in Minneapolis.
My guest is Bob Mould, formerly of the band Husker Du. His band Sugar has a new album called File Under Easy Listening. More with Mould in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have from the UN Population Conference?
Terry, apparently what is occupying the minds of most of the negotiators there is how to get past the question of abortion. Noah Adams is still in Northern Ireland, and we'll have a piece from him on the peace dividend that Northern Ireland expects. The Air Force has charged the soldiers involved, the airmen involved in shooting down the two helicopters over Iraq. We also have some reports on the new leader of the National Symphony. His first concert is tonight. On the development of thumbs as an index of intelligence, and we also have a great gadget, the death clock.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back with guitarist, songwriter, and singer Bob Mould. I know there was a period during the 80s when you were doing speed, and I'm wondering if that helped with your music. I mean, if that put you more physically on the level that your music was.
I'm sure it had an effect on the music. I would guess, you know, very early on, maybe the first two or three records, it had a very pronounced effect. You sort of have to phase yourself down out of those kinds of things. That's something you can do when you're young, if you choose to. But you can't sustain that kind of abuse on your body on, you know, whether it's alcohol or, you know, any powdered drug or whatever. It's great when you're young. I think the music, at least for me, the compositional aspect of it changed when I got all that stuff. I think especially when I got alcohol out of my life in 86, you tend to really start to see the dark side of your work at that point. Because, you know, drugs and alcohol ultimately, you know, they're feel-good things. You know, they're not inspirational devices. They never were to me. It was a feel-good thing. And once you take that good feeling away and you have to look in the mirror at yourself clearly, then you really start to see what's been going on. And that's when you start to pick up all the debris, all the years and years of things that start to come back to you when you least expect it.
Well, I guess looking at the bright side, at least you were able to put that in your music.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot to contend with, and it took me a few years to figure out that that's what was happening. I think when I figured it out was probably in the middle of 88 during the writing for the workbook record,
mm-hmm.
the first solo record. I mean, a lot of things started coming at me that I had never had to think about before.
Like what?
Just, you know, the prospect of having to be an adult, the prospect of, you know, bridges you've burned, relationships that you've damaged, just, you know, the peril of youth. You know,
what was 88 a turning point that made you realize you had to become an adult?
Well, it was after a couple of years of being completely sober. It was after the breakup of Husker Du. It was after, you know, suicides and other drug things running out of control around me, and, you know, watching 9 years of your life disintegrate and having to start over. I mean, I think that as a, you know, as a fixed price menu is a big plate to deal with in front of you.
Was it alarming when Husker Du broke up? I mean, alarming in the sense that you maybe couldn't see ahead what was coming next?
Yes and no. Frightening to not have the safety net, but so exciting to fall a couple times on your own.
Mm-hmm. Well, after Husker Du, you had, I think, a cabin in the woods of Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
which you worked, I guess, alone for a while. What effect did that have on you?
Well, that was, it was a really, you know, it was a sort of a frightening period at first, but it was really, you know, it could be as liberating as I wanted it to be. There was no rules anymore. I didn't have to write for Husker Du. It didn't have to sound like Husker Du. I could start to, you know, explore other styles of music. I could start to, you know, craft my own individual voice as opposed to being part of a collective voice. I mean, that's a lot of work. It's a lot of fun, too. The setting up in northern Minnesota was very, very, very isolated. I rarely saw other people. It was just, you know, putting the nose to the grindstone and trying to relearn how you express yourself.
So how do you think your current band, Sugar, compares to Husker Du or to the work you did when you were solo?
Sugar is an interesting case. After the two solo records, I dissolved the band that I put together for that. The musicians I was working with went out and did about a year's worth of solo acoustic dates in '91, and had quite a backlog of songs. Knew David and Malcolm from different scenarios, you know, producing Malcolm's band, the Zulus, in '88, and knowing David's band, Mercyland, who were in Georgia during the late '80s, sent them some work tapes of, a huge stack of songs and said we should get together and record. And it was not with the notion of it definitely being a band or anything. It just sort of came together. How it differs from Husker Du, you know, we're not a gang. We're three people, you know, at least 30 and older, who get together to play music. We're not trying to change the world. We're not trying to, you know, we're not trying to destroy modern music. We're just, you know, I look at it as a real fun experience. You know, there's no strings attached. David has two other projects he works on. Malcolm has at least three other bands he's in. You know, we live at least 1,000 miles apart from each other. You know, we work a lot by mail. It's good.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
All right, thanks, Terry.
Bob Mould, his band Sugar, has a new album called File Under Easy Listening. Fresh Air's director is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Barbara Bogave and Jewel Bracey. Jewel has worked with us part-time through the summer. Just our luck, now she's found a real job. She'll be the morning anchor at a news talk station in northern New Jersey. We wish her the best. We know she's got a bright future. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, it's our weekly archive edition. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for some favorite interviews from the past on the next Fresh Air.